Hello, everybody, and welcome to the free preview for this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie, all about the Iron Giant. I am one of your hosts for this one, the CoffeeZilla drinker, Bob Mackey, who is here with me today.
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, ducking and covering for perfect safety.
This IKEA table will surely protect us from nuclear holocaust.
But hey, welcome to this week's podcast. Yeah, we did Iron Giant as our What a Cartoon Movie, which is exclusive to $10 and up patrons at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
Yes, we wanted to get in under the door before it slammed down for the 20th anniversary of The Iron Giant, which came out in August of 1999. So we talked about this movie for over 4 hours, correct, Henry?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. Deep into the history of the film, history of Brad Bird, history of the Warner Features Animation, the doomed group whose only success was Space Jam.
Oh, you didn't like the Pagemaster?
Or even doomed films like Cats Don't Dance.
That movie is full of cats dancing, and that's why it failed, gentlemen. But yes, so you're going to hear a little preview of that very long podcast, a little preview of the history of the Iron Giant. But if you want to hear the entire thing, you have to head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. That will give you access to this full-length version of the Iron Giant What a Cartoon Movie podcast, but also the previous, 12?
13. Now, yeah.
Wow. 13 What a Cartoon Movie podcast, all roughly around 3 or 4 hours long.
Yes, those films include A Goofy Movie, Aladdin, Tiny Toons How I Spent My Vacation, The Cowboy Bebop Movie, Nightmare Before Christmas, Toy Story, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Kiki's Delivery Service, Akira, and Batman Mask of the Phantasm. And some I still am forgetting because there was just so gosh darn many. Secret in Him.
That's
There's
right.
A Secret in Him in there, which that is a big subject in this podcast as well.
Yes, we always tend to touch upon the late 70s, early 80s Disney doldrums, which is a big time for animation. But yes, if you sign up at the $10 level, you get access to that. And if you're not a patron yet, you'll also get access to all of the $5 rewards. Too many to list in this little preamble here, but that's over 100 bonus podcasts and more to come. There's so many things that are exclusive to the Patreon that you're missing out on if you're not on there at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
So without further ado, why don't you grab your Turbo Twinkies and give a listen to this preview of the history of Iron Giant. So by the mid 80s, Bird, though, was still working a lot with Steven Spielberg. He was working on some scripts. He's the writer of Batteries Not Included. Like, he wrote that screenplay.
I did see that. That's crazy. Henry, the name is asterisk Batteries Not Included. You have to say that out loud.
The asterisk is silent to me. But he also was working on Steven Spielberg's anthology series, Amazing Stories, which is kind of Spielberg's like nicer version of Twilight Zone, I guess you'd say. It was even more open. It was just really a way to put like short films on television. Mm-hmm. And he wrote one episode in season one, but in season two was really when Brad Bird took off with the 1987 episode of it called Family Dog that he directed.
Oh, yeah. I didn't see this when it originally aired, I don't think, but I remember seeing reruns of this on USA as a kid in the 80s, and I was just glued to the TV because this was pre-Simpsons, the closest you got to The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that Family Dog is, you can see a little bit of the roots of The Simpsons there, and it explains Bird's career trajectory too, I think. But yeah, the Family Dog was this idea. He came up like right after Disney, and at first he was going to make it as a film short in the early 80s, but he couldn't get it off the ground. He finally sold it to Spielberg, and it was a $1 million episode of TV. Wow. Which like in 87, that's pretty crazy.
It looks like it too. And a brief Family Dog cameo in The Iron Giant.
Yeah, I love that. I have forgotten that bit in there. And also, if you've seen Family Dog, you're like, this kind of looks like a Tim Burton thing. Tim Burton did do character designs on it back when he first thought of it.
I can see that very triangular head on the dog being a Tim Burton creation.
I mean, it's Frank and Weenie's brother, that dog.
That's true.
Also, at some point in the 80s, though, tragedy entered Brad Bird's life where his sister Susan was tragically shot and killed by her husband.
Oh, like, I didn't know this. Wow.
Yeah, it's a disturbing moment that Brad said hung over his life all through the 80s as he's also trying to finally get to direct a film, you know, and it's just not going. He has all these projects. Then on top of that, then he has to, like, his sister he was very close to killed by a gun, which that would later inform some of his artistic choices on The Iron Giant. After Family Dog is this big, you know, word of mouth success, everybody's like, oh, The Family Dog. Wow, wow, wow. 1989, as Bird is working on a bunch of other projects that are stuck in development hell, including a film I've never seen him talk about. I only know from a Variety headline. It's like, 1989, we've got a deal with Brad Bird to direct a live action film about a boy who lies to his younger brother that he's adopted.
Hmm.
I never,
sounds
nothing
hilarious.
Ever happened to it. Yes.
It's not the comedy.
It's a comedy. So in 1989, as he's trying to get a bunch of projects going, Brad Bird is hired by Klasky Csupo to be the executive consultant on a new show they're working on about some yellow family.
It'll never work.
But yes, he, as Brad described it, from seasons 1 through 8, he basically worked 2 to 3 days a week on The Simpsons as an executive consultant, meaning he was on the animation side working out of both Klasky Csupo and then Film Roman. When animation would come through, he would kind of just, you know, look over it as well, give any notes he had, and generally help with, like, defining the rules of The Simpsons world. I think probably David Silverman is probably the most influential artist on Simpsons animation, but I'd say Brad Bird's probably pretty close behind him there.
Yeah, I think both those guys leaving around the same time really affected the visual flourishes of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear him on a few commentaries, actually, on the DVDs. He didn't do a lot of animation, but he always got to do, like, one Krusty scene whenever he wanted to, because he loves Krusty and he loves animating Krusty.
Yeah, and as Ian Jones-Quartey talked about in our recent podcast about Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire, that Brad Bird wrote the guidebook for storyboarding The Simpsons.
Okay.
Like, the rules of it, he wrote it. Like, that's how much he defined it. So, like, layout and posing and all that, that was really defined by him in those early seasons. Like, it's, and his animation practices, like, echoed through primetime animation from then on. Like, that's how influential Brad Bird was without us even knowing it as executive consultant on The Simpsons.
I have to go check out that Family Dog TV show they made with him. I really wonder what it looks like. I saw a few when it aired as a kid. I don't have any memories of it, really, outside of one very, like, distressing episode I watched.
I think he actually only has, like, creator credit on it. I don't think he was that creatively involved.
I know that was a real development hell thing that eventually it aired in, like, 92 or 93.
It took them forever.
Yeah.
And just made 10 episodes, and once it was done, like, that's what could have happened to The Simpsons. Like, they could have just said, we made 10. Fuck it. Just put it out. We don't care. Yeah. Brad Bird defined so much of the content of Simpsons. You'll just hear so many times on commentaries, artists will say, oh, that was a Brad Bird note to do X and Y, or Brad Bird really liked this bit here, and Brad Bird did this. Like, they all loved Brad Bird. I think just like we talked about in the Kiki's Delivery Service, about how Miyazaki worked at Telecom and TMS and was really influential just on all the artists under him. I think Brad Bird had a similar effect. He only directed fully one episode, and that was Krusty Got Busted in season 1.
That's right.
That was from, like, emergency. They're like, we need another director here.
Who here's directed? Hands up.
And he would co-direct, like, Father Like Clown, too, which he did a lot. He's on the commentary that it's pretty good. You can see here his forceful personality there. It's also funny to hear them on commentaries, like, start to grow more respect for Brad as he succeeds without them. And they're like, oh, I guess he wasn't just, like, one of our art slaves who draws our jokes for us.
Post-Incredibles.
While working on The Simpsons, you know, like you said, 2 or 3 days a week, he still has time to work on some other stuff. So he signed a development deal with Turner in Turner's slowly growing feature animation business, because, as we all know, by 1990, 91, Disney has restarted their feature animation boom, and all the other animation companies are like, why aren't we doing this? We could do this.
And there wouldn't really be a strong competitor until Shrek, right?
Yeah, pretty much. DreamWorks was the only one that could actually pull it off. But Turner thought they could do it. You know, they did the complete mess that was the Jetsons movie.
Oh.
They did Pagemaster as well in 94.
I was just talking about that the other night. As a kid, I was like, I like books and I don't want to see this. I like books and Home Alone. I'm your market for this.
That's how much they blew it. But while those films are being made, Brad Bird is trying diligently at Turner to sell his film Ray Gunn, that's with two N's, which is Raymond Chandler meets Buck Rogers, as he described it.
Sounds great.
It looks, there's concept art out there you can find. Search for Brad Bird Ray Gunn. It does look really cool, but Turner just wasn't into it, probably because it was pitched as like a PG-13 kind of film that has more adult undertones, and it's about like murder and femme fatales and all these things that, like, you know, he loves, and this is also the same kind of spirit that brought him to the spirit, like those same kind of stories, but he just couldn't sell it to Turner. That takes us to 1995, where he's still having trouble with Ray Gunn, and Turner merges with Warner Brothers, effectively killing the project because the new Warner execs just aren't into it at all. They're not even like, oh, you can't rework it. Like, nah.
Yet somehow they did finish Cats Don't Dance that transition and buried it.
It actually, Cats Don't Dance has a very similar path as Iron Giant of just like, it's too far gone. Let's just finish it.
And it was being developed for a long time. I think it started as like a Michael Jackson project.
I think so.
We'll get to that movie at some point.
We gotta do that one, yes.
You can rent it on YouTube. It's the only place to get it.
Soon it'll be on HBO Max, I'm sure.
I'm sure it will.
But yes, now Brad Bird was an employee of Warner Feature Animation in 1995. But what is Warner Feature Animation? Well, as we've talked a little bit about in it, the Batman Mask of Phantasm episode, Warner in the 80s was, their films were pretty much just making compilation films with the remaining surviving Termite Terrace animators, like getting Chuck Jones or Freeling to animate worse looking things around their old shorts.
And getting a dying Mel Blanc to rasp into a microphone between cigarettes. Yeah.
I'm Daffy.
When they cut between old like 50s Daffy and late 80s Daffy, it's astounding. It's shocking. Like, oh yes, people do age.
Yeah, it was sad stuff to watch. Though those still were, especially the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner movie, like that was a formative viewing experience for me. That might have been one of the first times I really saw Bugs Bunny cartoons. Like, it was my favorite Bugs thing at first.
I'm pretty sure Quackbusters was my favorite, mainly because of the Ghostbusters connection.
Sure, sure.
But also, I think there's better new stuff in the framing device.
Yes, I would agree with that. I mean, I think as an old animator, Chuck was better than Freeling, but he got all the little nose twinkles
all the like long eyelashes on characters.
Overdoing it there. Like,
not everything is Ricky Ticky Tavi, okay?
If I must critique a dead man here, but yeah, so that's what Warner is up to. 1989, Little Mermaid comes, and it's just boom. And this is after the Bluth films. It's just like, oh, Disney and Dan Bluth have recreated feature animation. It can make money. Warner's looking pretty cheap by comparison. Now, you're seeing in 1990 that they are challenging Disney Afternoon with, you know, Tiny Toons. So I think there is this feeling among Warner execs of like, we have to match Disney in all things. Like, we're challenged to defeat them, as they still are now with the superhero movies. And so the next 5 years of 90 to 95 is Warner doing the economically safe move of finding animated films from other people and then distributing it, not doing the full budgeting of like paying for it themselves to make it. That starts with releasing absolute dog shit like Rover Dangerfield in 1991. Forgettable Bluth work like Thumbelina in 1994. And then transforming a direct-to-video movie in Batman Mask of the Phantasm into a theatrical release film. But in all those cases, regardless of quality, it showed that Warner really didn't know how to market an animated film in the way Disney did. Because, you know, a lot of times, especially with kids' movies, it's more about marketing than even quality as far as it goes. And they just didn't know how to sell it to kids and get them in the theaters. By 95, Warner decides it's time to invest in their own films instead of releasing other people's movies. So they start that with what will be their biggest hit probably ever when you take into account merchandise.
Space Jam.
Yep. It's Welcome to the Slam and Come Up and Jam.
Are they still making a sequel to Space Jam?
I mean, they say they are. LeBron and Ryan Coogler and all these folks, They say it's happening.
You really have to read the, I believe it's Cartoon Brew. They have an oral history on Space Jam. It just sounds like the biggest cluster fudge of a production.
It, I can't imagine that a cartoon, the film that started as a commercial would be that complicated.
Oh, it was.
Yeah, no. And I mean, it's a weird and clunky film that also really marginalizes animation and shoves it to the side. Like, just try to find out who led the animation on that film. It won't be easy to find
one
out.
One of 30 directors.
And so, unfortunately, though, it's hard to argue that it was a big success for Warner, and compared to all their other ones, like, it is the standout. Like, so, 95, as they're working on Space Jam, they also are working on what's going to be, they think, their Disney killer, Quest for Camelot, their princess movie.
Oh, it's bad. It's so bad.
And the production sounds like it's worth its own podcast of mistakes and problems. But in general, folks blamed the issues with Quest for Camelot with meddlesome executives and a lack of infrastructure needed to actually copy the Disney production pipeline that they were trying to emulate. Warner, just starting up a feature animation studio the way they did, that was a shitload of money. Then they're finding out how expensive animated movies are, and you can see why execs are now second guessing everything. We're like, it shouldn't cost as much. No. So Quest for Camelot is becoming a giant boondoggle of losing money. It's losing staff and actors, multiple directors. Like, it is costing Warner tons of cash. They also inherit Cats Don't Dance in 1997, and they just kind of shove it out because they have no clue what to do with it. It's a critical darling, but with little fanfare, a precursor to Iron Giant for sure. So with all that going on in 1997, Allison Abate, a producer at Warner, she is looking to find a director for another of their stalled projects, an adaptation of the Ted Hughes book, The Iron Man.
Now, I took a look at this because I never read it, and it is a very different story than this movie. What they have in common in Iron Man, what they don't have in common, mostly everything else.
Yeah, it's set in England. It's about a boy and his father. It's about a town that finds out about the giant very early. It has nothing in common with the eventual product we got. But when they licensed it, they saw it as a Disney-style musical that would adapt a stage musical that was done by Pete Townsend of The Who.
That's so weird.
But they couldn't figure it out. Like, they licensed it from Pete Townsend in the early 90s. That's why he's still an executive producer on this film. But they just can't figure out what they're doing. They're also like, they think it's going to be full CGI because they're working on it post-Toy Story, you know, in 95, 96, 97. They're like, we can do this in CGI. On the Blu-ray, there's some test footage of what they thought it would be, and it just, I know it's test footage, but it looks real bad. Like, they just didn't understand what they wanted it to be. So, Allison Abate, she sees that they just inherited Brad Bird from Turner. She's looking for animators who could take over this film and find a way to get it out of development hell. And Brad Bird really hooks into some of it. He loves a story about a boy and a robot, especially, and partially calling on his family tragedy with gun violence, reimagining it in a childhood not unlike his own. He wants to add in a ton of Red Scare stuff and ditch the Pete Townsend music and just make it about a gun with a soul, a gun that doesn't want to be a gun.
I'm really glad this came out in 99 because I think the door was closing around that time for like a detached look at the 50s, an ironic look, because, you know, the way nostalgia moves, we were ready to look back at other decades with scorn. But now was the perfect time because the things that we grew up with as kids, like The Simpsons and Mystery Science Theater, were all about poking fun of the square, weird values of the 50s and the paranoia that people had and fear.
And all the B movies those children of the 50s watched on television, which we only watched when Mystery Science Theater watched them.
We had jokes laid on top of them for us, for our safety.
And when he said to ditch the Pete Townsend music, you would think that's the end of it right there, because I would think if this was adapting a musical by a lot of people, the musician who's highly respected would have said, you cannot delete my music. But Pete Townsend apparently just had the expression like, eh, I got paid.
Apparently Whatever. That album just exists on its own too.
Yeah.
It came out in 89. So you can listen to that interpretation of a very different story.
As like the Who's Tommy kind of version of it. So Brad Bird was hired based on his passion for the project. Like, Warner execs were like, wow, he really gets this. Like, he's so excited to make this. And so Bird got to work on a script with Tim McCanley's, and the project would get 2 years of production. Now, as Brad Bird would explain it, this was with one third the money of a Disney or DreamWorks film and half the production schedule.
Yeah, on the commentary, they tell a lot of great stories. One of them is they basically had 9 months of pre-production, which sounds like a lot if you're not in animation, but it's no time at all. Usually it's like over a year, 18 months, 2 years before you actually have to start animating scenes. Mm-hmm. They had 9 months to figure out their entire story and storyboard it.
Yes, fully storyboard in a major motion picture, because once that 9 months is up, then they're in a huge rush to like assign out scenes to all the animators they hired and get stuff overseas. Like, it's so much they have on their plates.
And I think the budget was $48 million, and like Lion King and things like that were over $100 million easily.
Yeah. The one they compared to in the documentary is Tarzan, because that was like the contemporary production that they all knew about was happening at Disney. And like, there's a great scene in the documentary filmed during production where Brad Bird is talking to his crew, and he's just like, we finished 3 weeks before Tarzan, and they had a whole year more than us in production and 40 more animators. So fuck them. Like, he's like, as I've read in many accounts of the folks who loved working for him, like, they compared him to like Maximus from Gladiator, just like this great inspiring general they all loved working for.
Now, if you think about the budget and while watching the movie, it's a very good looking movie with very good looking character animation, but it is sort of an empty movie in terms of the amount of characters you meet. It's usually just a few characters on the screen. There's some random townsfolk, but not very often. It's just like a movie about a few characters.
Yeah.
It's not a big ensemble movie.
It's a really good point. Like, you compare that to like the number of characters you see on screen in, say, Aladdin or Beauty and the Beast. Like, it's a less cluttered film, I guess you could say. And I think, though, they hide that they made that budget work so well for them. Like, they hide it so well, like how their limitations. And you listen to the commentary, all they talk about is limitations they had.
And how much they had to cut and how they had to simplify scenes. It doesn't really come off as that obvious. And unless you think of the money and you'd say, oh, there'd be people here, there'd be traffic here, there'd be a crowd here, things like that.
Yeah, you don't think about like these crowd shots. One of the first scenes in the movie is a boat with one guy on it. And they talk about how like this is supposed to be a giant boat full of people, but they just had to keep cutting and cutting anywhere they could.
Yeah, Warner Brothers said you can't even have water. It's too expensive, but they figured it out.
It's and the water looks great for how little they've got.
It still looks good, yeah.
So Brad Bird started staffing up. One of the first guys he hired was the head of the story department, who was overseeing all the boarding of it, Jeffrey Lynch, who is one of the strongest directors from The Simpsons seasons 1-7.
Oh, yeah. Directed my favorite episode, Who Shot Mr. Burns Part 1. And apparently he didn't do any animation on this, but there was so much of him all throughout this movie in terms of the storytelling, both visually in terms of the story that's being told. And also, I was watching the credits. I had no idea he was part of this movie, and I saw him as like one of the first people listed. Jeffrey Lynch, J-E-F-F-E-R-Y. I'm like, is that the same Simpsons guy? They spelled his name wrong, and that's never been fixed.
Oh, that's sad.
Instead of R-E-Y, it's E-R-Y in the credits. And I'm like, man. Oh, okay, I guess, sure. It's been how many years since the movie came out? You can't fix the credits?
Maybe it was a WGA thing. I don't know. I know on the commentary, like, Bird is so effusive with praise of Lynch. He's on it, too.
He's there, yeah.
He's just like, this one and Annie for storytelling, and that's all Jeffrey Lynch heading up the storyboard team. Like, he executed on him and the rest of the borders executed on the script and story that Bird and McCallness made like perfectly. Like, there's so many times on the commentary they're like, oh, this was your idea, Lynch, or you figured this out. We couldn't get this story point figured out till you did it. And like, I mean, you watch his episodes, or even just before he got to be a director on Simpsons, just his layouts and some stuff, they're just so like filmic, actiony. Like his last episode, the Hellfish episode, is a big action movie. Like, it's amazing to look at.
I'm just thinking of the scene in Who Shot Mr. Burns Part 1 when Homer's graffito tagging Mr. Burns' office, and the camera pulls out from him up into the ceiling of the room. He did that on his own, just that little shot.
Amazing. Like, that was a real get for Brad Bird. I mean, there weren't as many Simpsons. I looked through the credits of a lot of the major animators. Not a ton of Simpsons people, but just losing Brad Bird, Jeffrey Lynch, and a couple other folks I'm going to name, I think that is a big reason for an animation to come. And also losing David Silverman, but that's separate from this movie. That's a big change from season 8 to season 9. That really it's something Simpsons couldn't really recover from. I also think where Lynch got first worked with Bird, it was on the Do the Bart Band music video.
That's
like,
right.
They worked very closely together on that.
In Estonia or whatever, wherever they animated it.
And the head of animation was Tony Fusilli, who he was working with a team of animators smaller than most Disney features. And he would know because he worked on character animations for Aladdin in Aladdin, Mufasa in The Lion King, Esmeralda and Hunchback, and was coming off of running Quack Pack, or like being a lead animator on Quack Pack.
You know what? Randomly, I put one of those on. It looks too good for what it is. And then also randomly, it'll be a superhero show for no reason. They really couldn't find a premise for Quack Pack.
I mean, after being handed that, I could see why Tony Fusilli is like, I'm out of here from Disney. I want to work with Brad. He's finally getting to direct his movie. So big get for them too. Like, I think, you know, you hear all those character animations that he headed up. I think that you can really see a lot of that and like the specifics of movements, especially from like Hogarth and Dean and Kent Mansley. I mean, his animation is amazing.
Yeah, I enjoyed watching it with the commentary on to just turn off the dialogue of the movie and just stare at the faces, because the character animation, the facial animation is so good and specific, and I love it so much.
Something.